Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Nobody chose this. No one wants to be in a lockdown because of an historic, deadly pandemic. And yet, in this moment when the din of daily life has been quieted, maybe that's making room for something else, too.
It's been very lonely. It's been very quiet. I think the white noise of the city, finally, it's allowed me to hear a lot of my thoughts. And I didn't realize how much stuff goes through my mind, a lot of many thoughts that I have.
I started a garden. I am trying to be present in the moment and in the place, and I'm feeling very lucky to be in a place where I have lots of trees and birds and creator friends.
It's been difficult because I live in an area where I have not a single neighbor. So I've come to learn how to walk in my yard, look at the plants, notice when flowers are blooming, spending more time reflecting in that way.
That's Marie in the French West Indies, Benny in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and Juan in Brooklyn, New York. They're sharing their stories with Corona Diaries, an open-source audio project supported by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and the MIT Center for Advanced Virtuality. Now, Juan and Benny and Marie are all talking about the sudden loss of all the busyness that once dominated their lives. Your lives. My life, for sure. It's upsetting and unsettling to lose the activities that once filled our days and marked our accomplishments. But again, is that also maybe allowing something else to flourish? So this hour on Point, let's talk about busyness and the virtues of experiencing more by doing less. And to help us think through this is Omid Safi. He's a professor of Islamic studies at Duke University and the founder of Illuminated Courses, where he's currently teaching a class on Rumi. You can find a link to some of his columns about busyness for the On Being Project. We have a link to those at onpointradio.org. Omid, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's really lovely to be with you.
How has your life been changed or transformed by this moment?
You know, I think, as you said, this is something that very few of us could have seen coming, and we didn't go into it with a map or with a plan. And I think in the first few days, like a lot of other people, I found myself experiencing a very deep sense of loss and focusing on all the things that we're not getting to do. And I'm very fortunate enough to be married to someone a lot wiser than myself. And so she very wisely turned it around for me and said, well, you know, everyone is talking about everything that is prohibited or recommended against. What is it that we are getting to do? What is it that we do want to use this time for? And my wife is a gardener. And so she very much speaks in these natural cycles. And the language that she gave me was a life that is not so much stripped down, but it is distilled. And that's kind of what the last few weeks have felt like. It really feels like distilling life to the essence. And we are much more trying, at least, to be present with one another, focused on checking in with loved ones on very simple home-cooked meals, when we are able to take a walk outside. And And there's actually, you know, something quite beautiful in the midst of the storm that is around us and all of the uncertainty and all of the suffering that we see. I think there's some sense that the pace of life that we were living before was not so humane.
Mm-hmm. So we should just acknowledge right here at the top of this discussion that there are many people right now who don't have a choice, right, Professor
Absolutely.
Safi, because they have to continue. They are the essential workers of this nation that are keeping us. They're holding us together, so they don't have a choice. They are as busy, if not more, than they ever were before. And we should also note that there are many people who have a lot of time on their hands that they simply do not want because they are out of work. So I just want to, you know, I just want to say that there's
Absolutely.
There's this range, and I wanted to acknowledge that, not to diminish what you're saying, but it's part of the whole picture.
Exactly. And I think it's a good reminder that, you know, sometimes we use this language that we're all in this together. Well, we may be all in it together, but we're not all in it in the same way.
Yeah.
And it has very different consequences for us. And I think, you know, we're seeing some of the much deserved attention that the healthcare providers, that the people who stock grocery stores, that the postal workers, that the essential services are providing. And one of the things that I really appreciate, and every time I see people going out and clapping for healthcare workers as they're getting off their shift, is a reminder that what we're really choosing to value is service.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who are extending themselves in love and service and care towards others.
Yeah. So this too is a form of distillation, though, right? Because when we talk about, I mean, the process of distilling is a purification process, right? So it seems as if I think it is fair to say that all of us, in whatever way, have been forced by this moment to sort of really purify what it is that we value and then question or compare this our answers in this moment to what we were filling our lives with before. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And I think what I'm realizing the more I listen carefully to people is there are many people who are saying, yes, we would all like to be able to get back to work, particularly those who are out of work or those whose work has been diminished or have been furloughed. But I think what we don't want to do is to get back to quote-unquote normal, because what we're realizing is that what passed as normal before was actually not serving all of us. And what passed as normal before wasn't serving the whole of what it means to be human, that we were caught up in this pace of life
mm-hmm.
where we measured our worth and our value by what we were producing. And I think we're trying to find a different way of living, a different way of being that would say, no, actually, our lives have worth and dignity. And depending on the language people want to use, it's because of the extent that we're able to love and care for one another. It's because of your soul. It's because you are a luminous being, a child of God. People have different languages for it, but I think we want to get away from that hyper-capitalist sense that my worth as a human being is measured through the dollar amount that I can generate for a corporation.
Yeah.
At the same time that, yes, of course, we want to be able to get back to work and help people economically recover.
So then let's get down to essentials. These words, distillation, pure, essential, they're going to come up multiple times, I feel,
yeah.
in this conversation. But so then is that how you are defining busyness or the problem of busyness? How are you defining it?
You know, it was actually a very simple observation some years back that I kept asking my friends in a very casual sense, you know, how are you? And the response I noticed that I got was not good or bad or angry or sad. It was just this nodding of the head. Oh, you know, I'm so busy, so busy, so busy, so busy, so busy. And no one looked happy when they said that they were so busy. And it got me to sort of realize, like, how did we end up like this? We don't want to be like this. We're supposed to be human beings, not human doings. And I realize that if I tap into the wisdom of my own tradition, and I speak here as a Muslim, in many Muslim languages, when you ask someone how they are, the question you literally ask them is, how is your heart doing? And I realize that when I ask people that question, how is your heart? Or how is your heart in this moment? People would pause and it would almost catch them and be like, oh, my heart. Yes, I have a heart. Let me look into my heart and let me see how that heart is doing. And it gave us an opportunity to move from this conversation of busyness and of action and activity to realizing that we're supposed to live a balanced life of action on one side and repose on the other.
So many questions to ask you, Professor Safi, but in the short time we have before we have to take a quick break, you're a scholar of Rumi. Do you find inspiration in Rumi's poetry, in Rumi's verse, to help us understand this?
I do. He speaks to me as he speaks to so many of us. And, you know, when I found myself under quarantine, my wife said, well, why don't we take this time to go deep into his teachings? And that's what led me to put this course together on Illuminated Courses. There's a poem that if you have time, I'd love to read it for you.
We have about a minute, to be perfectly frank, because I don't want to rush you. Can it fit in a minute or should we do it when we come back from a break?
Let's do it when we come back.
Let's do that.
It gives us a lot of cure and antidote for this disease of busyness.
Okay. I'm glad that you said that because it would be a true shame for me to rush you in an hour where we're supposed to be considering the virtues of repose. So Omid Safi, professor of Islamic studies at Duke University, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about questioning busyness in the midst of this global pandemic and whether our forced collective slowdown is actually making room for something else. Does this resonate with you? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about whether our collective forced slowdown might be making room for something more, something new. Not that any of us want to have to live under lockdown in a pandemic, but this is also a moment to ask some questions about all the things that were keeping our lives extremely busy before we entered this historic moment. And in order to help think through those questions, I'm joined today by Omid Safi. He is a professor of Islamic studies at Duke University and founder of Illuminated Courses, where he's currently teaching a class on Rumi. And Professor Safi, you were about to share with us some of Rumi's verse that you find particularly inspiring at this moment.
Yeah, thank you so much. We were speaking about distilling one's existence, and the way that Rumi talks about it is to go back to the roots of your being. So it's a tree metaphor, and to rejuvenate yourself by going back to the roots. And so he has this one poem I've been discussing on these Illuminated Courses, and this one is called Wherever You Are. So I'll just share this with you. He says, "Wherever you are, be right there, fully present. Have your heart be where your feet are. Wherever you are, be the soul of that place." And I think the reason that this spoke to me is I'm a teacher, and I realized how many of my students and my coworkers talk about multitasking as the default mode of being. They're reading and they're on their phones and they might be watching something and they might have headphones on. And, you know, many of us can imagine what this multitasking looks like, but we don't have even a good word for the opposite of that. What would it look like to be singularly present in the task that we're doing? I was mentioning to a friend, a lot of us can think of days where you get up and you're on your computer and then lunchtime rolls around and you're like, what have I done today?
Yes.
What have I actually accomplished today? And then you look and there's like 10 emails and 50 tabs that are open, but there's no sense of anything having been brought to fruition. And sometimes our conversations are like this. You know, we're sort of chatting with someone instead of really being present. And I think that's what Rumi is talking about, is whatever we are, whatever it is that we're doing, in that moment, have that task be what receives all of our mind, all of our soul, all of our glance. Whatever person we're with in that moment, treat them as the most important person in the world. And this is the language that the mystics use. Have your heart be where your feet are. Mm-hmm. And in some traditions, in Buddhism, for example, people talk about this as mindfulness. And I think I wish the English language could become a little bit more capacious and borrow some of these words from, for example, the Islamic tradition and have a word called heartfulness. I want us to have a heartful existence where we are fully present to one another. And then when that moment goes on, then we move on to the next task and we be heartfully present there and so on, instead of always being scattered brained and scattered attention and scattered hearted.
Well, I would just like to note that that is a beautiful and worthy goal. And at the same time, though, we have I'm not a Luddite by any stretch of the imagination, but we have a modern life that's with very powerful forces that are quite aligned against that goal.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, the phrase is the attention economy. Everyone is vying for your attention. It is being shattered at every second by design.
Absolutely. And, you know, when the human attention becomes a commodity, and it's something that is part of the marketplace, then people, as you say, are competing for it. I think what I'd like to do is to have us cherish our attention, to have us cherish our presence, and to say, this is something really precious. And I don't want to simply be casting it away on the wind. And the analogy that I give my friends and my students, and this works for them, is I ask them, like, you know, observe themselves next time that they notice their red battery light on their phones coming on. When they think their phones are about to die, it's almost like they go into this cosmic and existential state of panic. Because, you know, for them, if their phones die, they die. And they're just like frantically looking around for a place to recharge, even if they have to sit on the floor next to some smelly bathroom somewhere. They will sit there so they can recharge. And I ask them, like, have you attempted to be as attentive to your own heart? Do you know when your heart has the red battery light on? And when you notice that you're running on fumes, do you know what to return to rejuvenate yourself? Right. So this is that going back to the roots.
That's right.
And for some people, there might be some people that when you're with them, they fill you, they rejuvenate you. For some people, there might be a place. For others, it might be a practice. Whatever it is, find it and do it and do it again and again and again until it becomes a habit. Mm.
Well, so Professor Safi, if you just hang on here for a moment, I want to open the door to another voice in this conversation. And joining us from Dublin, Ireland is Brian O'Connor. He's a professor of philosophy at University College Dublin and at the University's Center for Ethics in Public Life and author of Idleness, a philosophical essay, a book that challenges the case against idleness. So, Professor O'Connor, welcome to you. Brian O'Connor, can you hear us? We're going to try to get him back on the line here. So, Professor Safi, let me just turn to our callers. Let's go to Madeline, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Madeline, you're on the air.
So I was calling in because I think this is a really interesting conversation about force slowing down, and it's definitely something I'm experiencing at the moment. I just graduated from nursing school, and prior to nursing school, I was a total wild child. Like, I used to hitchhike around, and I was a musician. And when I started nursing school, like, my schedule became tight, and I became really tight and wound up and just really hyper-focused. And now that I've graduated and I'm waiting for my job to start, the process of unwinding has caused me, like, a lot of anguish, and the transition was really hard. I had to call a suicide hotline last week because I feel like my identity has totally been changed, and I'm trying to, like, figure out what is going on with myself. But I've been rediscovering some of my artistic endeavors, so that's been helping me, and I feel a lot better now. But it's been really hard.
Yeah. Madeline, don't hang up. And first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm glad that things seem a little better now. But I'd like you to talk for a second with Professor Safi. Professor Safi, I think what Madeline is saying, many people are probably feeling, that she talked about that sense of identity being broke down with the lack of activity.
Absolutely. And I'm so thankful that you have you've called in. And I also just want to applaud you for having the courage to give voice to the vulnerability. You know, we so often hide away from that. And if we can't face the suffering in our own self, how are we ever to confront somebody else's suffering? And I'm also especially moved that, you know, your career path has been to go into nursing. And I think this is one of the things that we notice, is that so often it is the people who spend their life providing care for other folks that themselves are also in need of being looked after. So we're not alone. And this is the strange part, is that it is an age of physical distancing, but we're not meant to be alone. So I think whether it is teachings or whether it's people, I hope that you are doing, and I hope that everybody else is, able to look at their own life's journey and think about who's loved them, who's befriended them. And thinking of love in a very expansive way, not just romantically. Who's taking care of you? Who's loved you in your life? And it might be a grandparent, it might be a neighbor, it might be a teacher, it might be a lover, it might be a best friend, it might be a puppy. and to sort of return to these relationships. And I do know that a lot of us are checking in so much more frequently with people who have loved us and have loved on us during the course of our life.
Madeline, what do you think about that?
I think that it's interesting that that the topic of others was brought up, like other people, because positive interactions with other people is so fulfilling and grounding, but being in such a strenuous program really stripped away the social circle that I had built once in my life, and school was just really isolating, and now that it's gone, I'm realizing how isolated I am.
Yeah.
So it's hard to rebuild that.
Right.
I just don't know how.
Well, Madeline, thank you for your call, and I wish you the best of luck. Maybe some of these basic steps that Professor Safi was talking about, which might be where you start. So, Madeline, thank you again for sharing your story. Let's try now. I think we have Professor Brian O'Connor on the line. Again, he's a professor of philosophy at University College Dublin. Professor O'Connor, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Sorry about the technical difficulties. It's a new consistent fact of life for us here on live radio in these times.
For you and for everyone else.
Well, so you've been hearing much of what Professor Safi is saying. And I wanted to start by asking you, Professor O'Connor, you wrote this book, Idleness, a Philosophical Essay. Is idleness the opposite of busyness?
Yes, I think so, although not in any simple way, because it's not always very clear that when we speak about idleness, we speak about it in the same way. One extreme is that idleness is like a vegging out, a doing nothing, almost vegetating. But the other version, and I think possibly this is the one that may appeal to the imagination at the moment, is a life where you're not dedicated to productivity, where you're sort of doing your own thing and making your own day in your own way, as far as you know, practically possible.
And what does that kind of... Continue. Go ahead, Professor.
No, I think your question was going to ask me to say what I'm going to say anyway. That kind of day is one where I think I'm really going to echo many of the things that Omid already said, where you have a very different sense of the importance of productivity, where you're no longer really measuring yourself in terms of your output. But a further thing I'd emphasize here is a very distinctive feature of contemporary age. It's been developing over centuries, but it's come to a completely abnormal level in recent times. It's a kind of busyness dedicated to sort of making a name for oneself, you know, establishing an identity, whether it be a social media identity, a presence, a personality, or a professional one, where visibility, where relentless visibility is required. I think that's probably the most stressful thing that many people put themselves through, is building a visibility which is highly dependent on whether anyone wants to look at you and whether anyone wants to regard you as worth looking at. I think an escape from that strikes me as a pretty liberating possibility.
Liberating, yes, but also it's a rejection of centuries of religious, cultural, and economic norms in the Western world, Professor O'Connor. I mean, we have an entire economy that's founded on a notion that idle hands are the devil's workshop. So productivity is indeed how people were measured.
Yes, yeah, that's very true. But I think we have to distinguish between the kind of productivity that we recognize as important to keep ourselves together, you know, to keep body and soul together, to maintain a kind of an orderly society. That kind of productivity is there to stay. And obviously that's the condition of human beings as creatures, embodied creatures on the earth. But there's another kind of work practice which seems to go well beyond that. And I'm certain that this is a change we've seen since, you know, the middle of the 20th century, which is where there seems to be an excess or surplus desire to work, to be seen to be work, and to be admired for work. So the sheer fact of being a worker becomes admirable in and above what it is that work needs to do. In the past, nobody was condemned for not working, provided they were productive when they needed to be. But in more recent decades, a kind of, what would you say, mythologization of the work ethic, which is, has never been greater in spite of the fact that we're not as religious in the West as we used to be, this kind of so-called Protestant work ethic that Max Weber described seems to have gone to wholly new heights.
Mm.
So it's kind of an escape from that, the need to be seen and to be admired as somebody who works well, even above and beyond what's required for basic production.
Mm. Professor Safi, your thoughts on that?
No, I think he's exactly right in the sense that there is something about the current economy and even the ways that it has crept into some of our religious language, which have become somewhat capitalistic in terms of their orientation. They've become marketized, that drives us to a life that is all work and no rejuvenation, all work and no contemplation. And I want us just to remember that it's also possible to have a different series of metrics whereby we measure a fulfilled life. And it could be as simple as asking ourselves perpetually, how deep is our love and whom do we serve? I've rarely met somebody who wants to have written on their tombstone, he was quite efficient in answering emails, right? But I think the way that people at the end of their life look back on their life as having been a sweet life and a beautiful life, it's directly related to how well they loved, not just romantically, but in all the expansive ways. And how did they also spend their life in service towards others?
Right.
So I think we are talking about a very, you're right, this is very countercultural in today's world. But I also think it gives us the promise of far greater happiness.
Well, Omid Safi and Brian O'Connor, hang on here for just a minute, because there is a lot more to discuss on this. When we come back, we are talking about whether this moment of forced slowdown for most of us is making room to ask some questions about what was keeping us so busy before. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be taking a look at innovation amidst the coronavirus pandemic and how ingenuity, leadership, and resources are being marshaled for the common good, from making more face masks to developing never-before-seen vaccines. So are you seeing innovation at work all around you? And how are you or your company innovating? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. We want to know what questions or thoughts you have about America's aspirations and capabilities for innovation in this pandemic. Again, that's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. And I just want to acknowledge that it seems rather ironic that I'm promoting that for tomorrow's show, because it's a very activity and work-based hour. And today, we're talking about pressing back, pushing back against the cult of busyness in America, and whether or not this forced slowdown that we're all experiencing is actually allowing us to do that. And joining us today for that conversation are Omid Safi and Brian O'Connor. And Professor Safi and O'Connor, and in fact, I don't actually see it as an irony that tomorrow we're going to be talking about innovation while today we're talking about heartfulness, as you were saying, Professor Safi, because if both of you would allow me one moment to just bring my own personal experience into this, to bare my soul here to the two of you, I want to be honest and say that I struggled a little bit in my preparation for this conversation, because I've marked my whole life by a sense of pride or desire to do the work that I have been and am engaged in. That I felt a sense and continue to feel a sense of, I don't know if accomplishment is the right word, but meaning. In working with great teams to put stories on the radio, or helping my child learn how to read, or to be active in my community. It seemed to be a very busy life on paper, but it provided meaning. And if I may, I would actually even quote Emily Dickinson. I was looking at a poem from Dickinson where she wrote, "I tie my hat, I crease my shawl, life's little duties do, precisely as the very least were infinite to me." So I guess I'm saying I still find meaning in a lot of my actions, in a lot of my work, in a lot of my busyness. And I'm not quite sure there's anything wrong with that. So Professor Safi, what do you think?
You know, I'm delighted that actually you find the work that you do meaningful. And I would rejoice if everybody finds the work that they do to be one that gives their life a sense of meaning. I am never against the sense of living a meaningful life. I hope that work has dignity in whatever sense it is that we do. I think the distinction I'm trying to make is that I'm not so persuaded that busyness and meaningfulness are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to be busy all the time, but not necessarily be engaged in activities that are particularly meaningful. And a lot of the work that is the most meaningful, you know, when you sit down with a loved one and you have your hand on their arm and you're listening very attentively, you may not look very busy in that moment, even though it's the most meaningful thing that you could be doing. So I would say the fact that your life is meaningful is wonderful. And I think a lot of us, myself included, who come from immigrant backgrounds, we've been raised to measure part of our contribution through the extent to which we can make a meaningful difference to the society that we now call home. I just want to make sure that that doesn't come at the expense of reflection and the examined life, as Socrates would call it, that ultimately makes it worth living.
Yeah. Well, Professor O'Connor, let me just put it this way, that sometimes I consider myself the most Protestant, non-Protestant in my belief in the Protestant work ethic. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's true that some professions have a certain space of freedom, which allows an individual to sort of take possession of their own time in a way that other walks of life don't. So I'm not sure how much we can infer from the fortunate cases like yourself,
right,
or indeed perhaps myself too. I worry about that many of the idealizations of work are built on models that are really not available to many people. And given the structure of industry and the interconnected ways in which our economies need to work, those kinds of professions are sadly for the few. Many others have a kind of a much more controlled workplace, and I think that makes a great difference. And indeed, we have to say that under the current crisis, those are people who probably won't find much to be impressed by in our conversation. These are people who are, you know, worried about what's going to happen next, and probably don't feel that this new space, if they're lucky enough to be able to sustain themselves, is one that can that can last forever. So many of us, in a sense, are in the luxurious position of thinking, what can we learn from this and bring forwards? And if we have certain kinds of professions, there's possibly a space for that kind of revision as we go forward. But lucky us is all I can say. It will be wonderful if I can echo your other guests that others had such positions, but we're not really structured to offer that to all, which is one of the nightmares of our world.
No, I absolutely agree with you on the fact that having the luxury to contemplate busyness versus idleness is a luxury and a privilege afforded to not enough people. I mean, we start, I'm not sure if you heard this, Professor O'Connor, but at the beginning of the conversation, we did, Professor Safi and I did make that point, and it's I'm glad you bring it up again. But so let me ask you then, though, Professor O'Connor, does this moment, can this moment, even for the people who do feel deeply concerned about their well-being, about their future, because the forced slowdown is actually quite damaging to them and their families, is it possible for – where do they begin to find some comfort, some solace in this?
I'm not sure there's much. I am sure their main hope is that we find some solution to their current crisis and – We get the show back on the road. The question is whether those who are fortunate enough not to have such great worries can perhaps, I guess, try to frame some of the experiences that many have gone through, and to offer something that might be potentially, you know, constructive in the future. I found the testimonies that you broadcast at the beginning of the show extremely moving. I listened to one with particular interest, the speaker from Brooklyn. There was a certain kind of anxiety in his voice. Mm-hmm. He was interested in what was going on around him, but there was an anxiety there about whether this was somewhere he could really go as, you know, as time moved on. I'm worried that we might leap to very general and radical conclusions based on an extremely unnatural sort of crisis, something that has happened very suddenly by public policy decisions, and that, you know, could be reversed and solved fairly quickly. We're very much in a historical moment,
yeah.
And I don't know what that really is just yet.
Right, and that's a really, really good point. So, Professor Safi, let me ask you, because I do wonder about this. If we're frank with each other, many, many people, and I will include myself in this, yearn to go back. This moment that we're in is not what we want. We yearn for the normalcy that we had before, even if it was marked by this plague of busyness. Forgive, I did not mean that. That was a terrible use of words. But you know what I mean. That to Professor O'Connor's point, this is an abnormal moment that people might welcome the return to the life we had before, where busyness was part of the mix. What do you think about that?
You know, you got to excuse me because I'm a religion professor and I tend to think of life and reality in religious terms. And to begin with, I think you always measure the sanity of situation, the compassion of a situation by the way that people on the margins are faring. And so I do ask myself that question, what does this mean about going back to something called normal when we don't have healthcare, mm-hmm. universal healthcare? Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing the ways in which the health and the well-being and indeed the very life of all of us is interwoven and interconnected. So what I always tell to people, and this is slightly ironic language, is that what I really hope we are experiencing, and this is with a twinkle in my eye, is an apocalypse. But what I mean by that is not apocalypse in the sense of the end of the world, but rather the original meaning of the word apocalypse, which is an unveiling. I hope that we're having the veils of illusion removed from us, that the old way that which we thought of as normal was actually the best way. I do think there is a better way possible. I do think there's enough food, there's enough health care, and ultimately enough love and dignity for all of us. But we're not going to do that going back to the old structures, as tempting as it is. My hope is that something about the unsettling aspect of this moment allows us to connect the inner to the outer, allow each of us to go deep inside and find us what makes us human, and then to bring that outward and to figure out how do we take care of all of us? Because I don't know that we have another option.
Well, so Professor O'Connor, just briefly, do you think that this sort of moment of, in a sense, forced decompression that we're experiencing could, again, what by the reduction of the din, of the busyness that was dominating so many people's lives, create the space for that kind of change that Professor Safi is talking about?
I would welcome that, but I have my doubts. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that we haven't gotten to the place we've been in by accident. It has been pretty much a case of a process of social evolution, of education, of training, of socialization that is very deeply ingrained in us, I mean, when you think about one of the complaints that many people have under the current lockdown is boredom. Mm-hmm. And boredom is always a symptom of not knowing how to spend your time in a way that's satisfying. And this is because people haven't really had the experience of having to spend so much time using their own initiative. We've been well trained to undertake tasks, to move to each task that's put in front of us. And successful people are those who identify the tasks and get them done quickly and impressively. But we're very much socialized as creatures of a certain type. And I guess I wonder whether when all of this is over, it won't be a little bit like those promises people make on vacation saying, oh, I never want to go back to work.
Right.
I'm going to read novels every day from now on. It just drifts away over time. I'm not saying this because that's the way human beings naturally are. I don't know what human beings naturally are. I suspect that we've been unnaturally socialized to be busy, right, though. I think that's going to be a generational process, mm-hmm, if we're ever going to reverse that.
Well, Brian O'Connor, professor of philosophy at University College Dublin and at the University Center for Ethics and Public Life and author of Idleness, a philosophical essay. Professor O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure.
And Professor Safi, you've got about 3 minutes left here. I was wondering if you could fit in another Rumi poem for us as a parting thought.
Absolutely. You can never have enough Rumi poems in your life. So this is one of my very favorite ones, and it's one that I think really addresses this question of suffering, which so many people find themselves in. And it's called, "The Wound is Where the Light Enters You." The wound is where the light enters you. And it sounds a little bit like that wonderful Leonard Cohen song, that anthem that has the line, "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." And it's not surprising, since Lenny Cohen was such a huge fan of Rumi, called him the greatest religious poet. So here's the poem. It says, "Trust your wound to a skilled healer. You cannot see the ugliness of your own wounds. Flies hover over them, your thoughts. Your wound is your heart's state, unilluminated. The healer, the sage, puts a bandage on your wound. The pain is gone. You think you healed all by yourself, but know this, the healing was from the light. The wound is where the light enters you. The wound is where the light enters you." And I think the reason that speaks to me so much is I know that so many of us feel like wounded beings, and so many of us are actually wounded, and there is suffering. I hope that through the suffering of this moment, through the reflection and our response and our love and care for one another, that there is a light that also enters us, that we're able to find out ways of living a more meaningful, a more sustainable, a kinder and gentler life that supports all of us.
Hmm. Well, Omid Safi, professor of Islamic studies at Duke University and founder of Illuminated Courses, where he's currently teaching a class on Rumi. Professor Safi, thank you so much for joining us today.
I thank you.
And by the way, I should note, today's the first day of Ramadan, so a special thanks for you for taking the time to be with us on this first day of Ramadan as well, Professor.
I thank you so much.
Well, On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amada, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Our co-captains are Graham Griffith and Jeb Sharp. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.